By the 1970s, there was strong outrage and general disorder. Sensing this, a paranoid white political establishment gravitated toward policies to further control the black community. Richard Nixon's chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, noted in his diary that Nixon held highly racist views. He wrote that Nixon emphasized that you have to face the fact that the whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to. Nixon is famous for starting the war on drugs in 1971, which was eventually escalated by Ronald Reagan in the 1980s and then Bill Clinton in the 1990s, resulting in an enormous disproportionate increase in black arrests and overall lower-class minority incarceration. Most serious researchers today are hard-pressed to view the origins of the American drug war as anything but a war covertly rooted in policy fought against the black community, the lower class, and subversive counterculture youth in general. This isn't to say the drug war was entirely deliberate in its targeting, but it is easy to see how policymakers could find ways to justify such actions in euphemistic ways, with the thought of social control and systemic oppression clearly in the back of their minds. After all, during the time of the drug war's conception, the two great forces proving they could alter the political establishment were youth and minority culture. The 1960s had some of the most effective social and civil rights movements in history. It is not out of the question for the political establishment to see this subculture as a threat, seeking means to deflate its power. As will also be discussed in Chapter 2, such dominance patterns have been constant throughout social evolution for a long time. In sum, the legal system morphed from direct racial oppression to indirect by targeting the outcomes of historical and present socioeconomic inequality, rather than any specific group. Between the draconian drug laws and the effects of destabilizing poverty and deprivation in the black community, law enforcement could easily fill its arrest quotas. Racial profiling doesn't need to be police policy when all police see day in and day out is minority crime. They have been conditioned by superficial experience to associate black culture with criminal behavior. This association can be largely unconscious, in the same way the white community has grown to associate the young black male with crime due to decades of biased portrayals in the news media. Then we have cultural relationships. Returning to my story, after my attack, I found myself reacting nervously when I would see a man of color walk toward me on the street. It was an irrational fear, emotionally triggered. As I had understood, even at my young age, that race wasn't real. Before my attack, this irrational fear wasn't an issue. Something snapped in my brain because of the trauma. While the effect went away after a few years, particularly when I attended a mixed-race international art school from the age of 13 on, I realized later that it wasn't just the traumatizing attack that created the effect. It was the overall social climate of paranoia and racism in the American South that primed me for the reaction, specifically the highly negative stereotyping of the young black male. For instance, there was a popular television show in my youth called Cops. This show featured white police arresting poor black men constantly. At the same time, news footage I would see of American prisons always showed a sea of dark-skinned people, while depictions of crime and drug-infested black ghettos painted a primitive, uncivilized picture of black society. Even in my elementary school, there was a subtle segregation, with black youths often undergoing more scrutiny and accusation than white youths. These children were also likely to underperform on tests. Such outcomes are troubling because they again reinforce superficial and bigoted assumptions. If people see statistics such as black children performing worse on academic tests, black adults arrested and incarcerated more, or higher black unemployment, they may superficially gravitate toward assuming it is just the way they are, having no other information. Our localized perception fails us in this way. Rather than looking at the condition the culture finds itself in, as cultivated over time by such former pressures as abject slavery and Jim Crow segregation, compounded by ongoing economic deprivation and poverty, it isn't difficult to see how a culture of misguided bias can be created and perpetuated, even without malicious intent. Now, returning to the issue of economy, the central argument here is that the economic foundation of our society is at the root of the problem. The early economic decision to exploit Africans for labor and profit helped give birth to the nature of our modern criminal justice system, resulting in a self-perpetuating machine of bias and bigotry. It is not just the generational tradition of racism in the white legal community that has created this pattern, but the ongoing socioeconomic inequality that has been common to the black community ever since. This has created a feedback loop that condemns the natural outcomes of socioeconomic deprivation, that is, crime, lack of education, further securing systemic oppression of the black and minority community by law enforcement and even society at large. A culture of aberrancy has also been groomed, such as the modern epidemic of black-on-black gang behavior in inner cities. While superficial assumptions condemn gang behavior, blaming the people involved, the reality is that this behavior has been the culmination of intersecting socioeconomic pressures over generations. In short, the consequences of systemic racism are now producing preconditions that ensure the future preservation of systemic racism. It is a cycle, and this cycle can't be broken in a real way without the removal of poverty and low socioeconomic status. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. understood this. While remembered mostly for his help in enforcing black voting rights, ending segregation, and promoting the Gandhian vision of nonviolent civil dissent, he also led an anti-poverty movement few seem to be aware of. Before his death, King was working on an economic bill of rights to basically end poverty in the United States. He knew that all the prior civil rights successes to help black culture prosper would not be as effective if the perpetuation of poverty continued. The systemic consequences of poverty were too strong, preserving bigoted reactions and oppression. To put it another way, the black community, no matter what legal or civil rights it obtained, was still locked into a tragic cycle of discrimination, and poverty was the binding factor. King made his position clear in his final book, Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community? He wrote, "We have come a long way in our understanding of human motivation and of the blind operation of our economic system. Now we realize that dislocations in the market operation of our economy and the prevalence of discrimination thrust people into idleness and bind them in constant or frequent unemployment against their will. The poor are less often dismissed from our conscience today by being branded as inferior and incompetent. We also know that no matter how dynamically the economy develops and expands, it does not eliminate all poverty." His solution was direct. Since the market system will unfold as it does, perpetuating its signature feature of economic inequality, the simplest approach was to install a universal minimum guaranteed income to counter it. He stated, "I am now convinced that the simplest approach will prove to be the most effective. The solution to poverty is to abolish it directly by a now widely discussed measure, the guaranteed income." He also added in the same spirit, "For years I labored with the idea of reforming the existing institutions of society, a little change here and a little change there, but now I feel differently. You have to have a reconstruction of the entire society, a revolution of values." Universal minimum guaranteed income means each citizen gets paid to live, with no job requirement. Whatever the poverty line may be, each person is supplied with that income directly, ending poverty. While King's solution was not systemic in the sense of seeking to change the actual mechanisms creating poverty itself, his understanding of the consequences of poverty certainly were. However, as this text will argue in later chapters, while patches such as universal minimum guaranteed income are just as relevant and needed today as they were in King's time, they are still only one step in the right direction, seeking, as he put it, a reconstruction of the entire society. Preconditions. Now, with the framework of systems theory in place, coupled with this background knowledge of the historical, cultural, and economic roots of institutional racism, and along with our understanding of how poverty and socioeconomic inequality are fueling the residual oppressive condition today, I will return to my story. Let's put ourselves in my assailant's shoes as a young black teenager existing as an extension of historical African-American oppression. I would like to consider possible preconditions that may have guided him to commit the assault and theft. The first and most obvious precondition is poverty itself, a characteristic inherent to the neighborhood, and, judging by his torn and dirty clothes, likely his economic state. Perhaps he needed the bike for transport or wished to sell it for money. These are fairly obvious and common considerations, so I won't belabor them. A second, less obvious possibility could be an interest in social status. It was clear that the bike was of high value, and, as we all know, appearances are given great weight in modern culture. Social status has become synonymous with material wealth, while the appearance of poverty implies personal failure. Interesting studies conducted on class inequality found that high status or high-priced goods are of more interest in places with larger wealth gaps between the rich and poor. Such research also notes how people in a more unequal region, closely witnessing material wealth outside their reach, are more prone to risky behavior to fit in or try to match others' status symbols. Psychologists have referred to this as wealth signaling or conspicuous consumption. On one end, we see strained purchases of high-status goods that have little to do with real human need by those who simply cannot afford them, including people going into debt simply to keep up appearances. On the other end, we see violent crimes of material lust, such as a teenager killing another for a pair of high-dollar sneakers or an expensive designer jacket. Underlying this tendency, as touched upon earlier, is our deeply social nature. Generally feeling connected, respected, and accepted by others to some degree is not a subjective preference. It is a hardwired emotional requirement for good health. How this expresses itself may be tempered by an individual's characteristics, but it is generally a universal phenomenon. Being without a sense of social inclusion, humans can become neurotic, just as our non-human primate brethren have also been shown to do in controlled experiments. As independent as we may feel, social connection is a deep need built directly into our evolutionary psychology. If connection is not obtained, imbalance in psychosocial or biological and psychological distortion can occur. The effects of exclusion, disrespect, and overall class status hierarchy can produce a spectrum of negative outcomes. Feelings of being marginalized or of having lesser value than others have been correlated with mental illness, violence, crime, heart disease, and a host of other public health issues. It is just as much physical as it is psychological, meaning people can be in social settings but still feel excluded owing to status perception and other influences. The materially obsessed consumer behavior we see today is really less about a given item's purpose and more about what that item means in terms of societal bonding. In effect, mere wants have been artificially turned into emotionally demanded needs by the drive for social inclusion. While many economists have argued that this insatiable desire is simply part of our shared human nature, it appears this tendency is only human nature in the sense of a shared social reflex, not some uncontrollable compulsion for material gain. As will be further explored later in this text, such materialism is really a byproduct of the nature of our economy itself, structurally induced. At the same time, this pattern also produces a kind of perpetual human dissatisfaction. In the words of psychologist David G. Myers, compared with their grandparents, today's young adults have grown up with much more affluence, slightly less happiness, and much greater risk of depression and assorted social pathology. Our becoming much better off over the last four decades has not been accompanied by one iota of increased subjective well-being. Because social connection and self-worth have been partly relegated to relative material success, people find themselves on what some social psychologists label the hedonic treadmill. The more wealth people generate in this environment, the more they tend to expect things, thus reducing their capacity to be happy with less. The effect also trickles down in a socioeconomically stratified society from the public perception of the opulent, creating a reduced sense of inclusion. It has been exacerbated in more recent times by the accelerated rise of modern consumerism. Avner Offer professor of economic history at Oxford University, details this evolution in his book, The Challenge of Affluence. He states regarding the effects in Britain and the U.S., "The goods in question, however dispensable in other cultures, were truly vital for social participation. As the 20th century unfolded, newly created conveniences and material goods became looked upon as essential, and to be without them was to be poor," he wrote. The rise of consumerism will be discussed more in Chapter 4. Returning to my story, given this cultural climate, there is the possibility that the visually stimulating high-dollar bike was less a means of utility or a source of monetary value than a status symbol, something he could show off to his friends. A third and perhaps even less considered possibility is that of my assailants feeling power and control in the act of dominating another. Poverty, while often talked about only in terms of material deprivation, is also about a lack of control, lack of respect, and feelings of shame and helplessness. Dr. James Gilligan, again the former head of Harvard's Center for the Study of Violence, had this to say about the relevance of power and respect in such acts. "I used to think that people committed armed robberies in order to get money, and indeed that is the superficial explanation that they would often prefer to give, to themselves and to us. But when I actually sat down and spoke at length with men who had repeatedly committed such crimes, I would start to hear comments like, 'I never got so much respect before in my life as I did when I pointed a gun at some dude's face.'" Psychological research shows that feelings of shame, inferiority, and being disrespected are foundational preconditions for violence and crime. If you have seen a bar fight in which the cause was merely one stranger uttering an insult to another, you have witnessed the reactive need for social respect. Because status is linked to material success in modern society, growing income disparity translates into self-worth disparity. Therefore, it is no mystery that feelings of inferiority, shame, and humiliation are staples of modern culture. There is strong epidemiological evidence that correlates the amount of violence in a region to the amount of class inequality. Gilligan and others have concluded that the broadest predictor of violent behavior is socioeconomic inequality itself. This is due not only to the material deprivation of poverty, but the stressful feeling of shame related to simply being lower in perceived status than other people. Studies also show this pattern with our non-human primate brethren. In strict hierarchical baboon troops of Africa, chain reactions of upper to lower status abuse have been observed. First, a dominant baboon strikes and humiliates a subordinate. The subordinate, knowing he cannot strike back, turns to strike his own subordinate to release the angst or save face. And on down the line it goes. These primate dominance reactions, often termed displaced aggression, mirror patterns in the human population, such as domestic abuse. Studies of husbands beating wives and children often find triggers related to job problems or other sources of emotional stress, ego loss, and feelings of inferiority. Sourcing a range of studies, domestic violence researchers Van Wormer and Roberts state, "Low economic status of men and the inherent stress of trying to eke out a living can also be a factor associated with violence, most likely in the form of displaced aggression by the husband onto the wife." Investigation of correlates of domestic violence found that the strongest contextual risk factor for intimate partner homicide is an abuser's lack of employment. This overall line of thinking has led Gilligan to conclude, "If we wish to prevent violence, then our agenda is political and economic reform." As for my assailant, one could speculate on a range of such possible influences, specifically related to his African-American history. Perhaps I was a symbol of white oppression or elitist wealth given the race-class tensions common to the American South at that time. Perhaps his family upbringing had clear victimization by white forces, part of a tradition of bias. Perhaps a perceived injustice occurred that very day that offended the young man, who then felt the need to take it out on me. In other words, his targeting me may have had a deeper, even subconscious basis, seeking to elevate his sense of control, power, and integrity. More broadly, the same kind of analysis can be applied to impulsive group violence, such as race riots. where people assault each other for no other reason than symbolic differences. For example, the Los Angeles riots of 1992 had many such characteristics. The poor, centralized black and minority population exploded in rage, ostensibly because of the acquittal of abusive police in a high-profile court case involving the beating of an unarmed black man. Yet many sociologists today source this rage to the poverty and oppressed socioeconomic conditions inherent in the community, with the acquittal of the white police merely a trigger for pent-up anger. In the words of sociologist Joel Kotkin, this wasn't a race riot, it was a class riot. Problem solving. Mohandas Gandhi was clearly aware of the influence societal structures have in shaping values and outcomes. He is famous for saying, "Poverty is the worst form of violence. It little matters to me whether you shoot a man or starve him to death by inches." This implicitly criticizes the existence of class inequality and its systemic effects. His view is unique as it alludes to a subject that will be discussed in detail later, something called structural violence. Structural violence, meaning preventable violence resulting from human-generated institutions, is an all-encompassing kind of indirect harm. In our localized sense of experience, we tend to think of violence as a direct, human-to-human affair, not a systemic outcome that tends to mask its original source. Stokely Carmichael also alludes to this systems-based view in the context of institutional racism. He wrote in 1967, "When white terrorists bomb a black church and kill five black children, that is an act of individual racism, widely deplored by most segments of the society. When in the same city, Birmingham, Alabama, 500 black babies die each year because of the lack of proper food, shelter, and medical facilities, and thousands more are destroyed and maimed physically, emotionally, and intellectually because of the conditions of poverty and discrimination in the black community, that is a function of institutional racism." Norwegian sociologist and mathematician Johan Galtung, who was highly influenced by Gandhi, formally introduced the term structural violence in 1969 and has written extensively about it since. In his work, he defined Gandhi as a structuralist, stating, "Gandhi saw conflict in the deeper sense as something that was built into social structures, not into the persons. Colonialism was a structure and caste was a structure, both of them filled with persons performing their duties according to their roles or statuses. The evil was in the structure, not in the person who carried out his obligations. Exploitation is violence, but it is quite clear that Gandhi sees it as a structural relation more than as the intended evil inflicted upon innocent victims by evil men." As mentioned in the introduction of this book, this structuralist, systems-based worldview is deemed critical to effective problem-solving. This fact applies not only to human behavior, but the spectrum of public health and ecological problems occurring in the world today. Any given problem, irrespective of its nature, will have systemic roots that facilitate or support it in some way. The question is, can those roots be changed to stop the negative chain reactions? This is not to argue that all negative outcomes can be eliminated or controlled by this approach. There are limitations, just as we cannot today stop the everyday spread of the common flu. Yet we can strategically limit our exposure to the flu and ensure the best conditions in our environment to lower the odds of its occurring. I doubt many reading this would decide to replaster a ceiling that keeps leaking every time it rains, knowing the real leak is on the roof of the building. Yet, our localized perception of the human condition is still plastering away. To stop the leak, we need to seek out and resolve root causes that continue to lead to social oppression, ecological disregard, and other influences that reduce human well-being. It has only been in the modern age that sociological research has provided powerful evidence of what's needed to resolve these problems. These new frameworks or models for understanding society must be applied if we expect to see true social progress. Chapter 2. Beyond the Pale, Our Social Mythology. This tendency prevails from the continental rationalists on, Leibniz, Spinoza, Descartes, Berkeley, Kant, and Hegel, for example, more or less entirely presuppose the social regime of their day and its constituent forms as in some way the expression of a divine mind, which they see it as their rational duty only to accept or to justify. John McMurtry. World history is interwoven with an endless thread of unique myths about the origin of life, powerful deities, heroic quests, afterlife, the end of the world, destiny, and various other sacred ideas and narratives inspired by existence. From Greek mythology with its 12 pantheon deities staged to demand obedience from us mere mortals, to Cavales, the virgin goddess of the Incas who ate fruit that impregnated her, only to then throw herself and her newborn into the ocean to be turned into rocks. Humanity's depth of creativity and capacity for invention is quite fascinating. Underlying these stories and symbols are attempts to make sense out of a chaotic, daunting world. The drama of the human condition certainly creates a need to believe something in an attempt to organize reality and better understand our own lives. It is no wonder, then, why moral dilemmas, dualities of good and evil, astrological determinism, destiny, controlling gods, judgment, and a litany of other common mythological attributes are replete in almost every historical culture on Earth. Since myths are culturally shared beliefs by definition, regardless of their truth, we can also understand the importance they have had in creating social cohesion, group mobilization, trust, and deep spiritual and philosophical bonds between people. It is in this framework that I would like to turn attention to secular mythology. As opposed to the traditional or sacred types just touched upon, secular mythology comes in the form of social, ideological, or political narratives. These narratives include a spectrum of ideas that effectively serve to bond people around normative societal traditions, structures, and methods. Social psychologists have categorized aspects of this tendency in the term legitimizing myths, meaning myths that serve to protect the status quo and assist social control. Whether dealing with nationalist, political, or economic loyalties, prevailing moral codes, underlying philosophies, or other dominant characteristics of society, there are numerous supportive myths that form a protective barrier around traditional values and practices. Our tribe. When it comes to secular mythology, there is perhaps no better case study than the nation-state and its tribal politics. Loyalty to a country, its people, and its methods, and shared opposition to its decreed enemies, is facilitated by a catalog of symbols, stories, ceremonies, revisionist history, and other elements that serve the interests of social cohesion and status quo support. If you've ever had that looming feeling of being brainwashed when singing your country's national anthem or pledging allegiance as a child, you are familiar with such ceremonial reinforcement, reminiscent of religion itself. Nation-states also tend to employ sacred symbols, another signature of religious culture. A nation's flag is one such example. Virtually all states, present and modern, have superimposed their sanctity onto flags, even including severe punishment, if the flag is ever desecrated or disrespected. This patriotic protectionism reflects just how serious keeping national respect is, especially during times of war. In fact, perhaps the greatest utility of such national mythology is to ensure that a citizenry willfully sanctions acts of state power, with any opposition considered sacrilegious or unsupportive of the national tribe. This tradition of unquestioningly holding military forces in high public esteem, psychologically buttressed by ubiquitous ceremonialism, including medals, parades, and other adornments, has been an historical constant across the world. The taboo against criticism is even extended to where questioning any aspect of the war apparatus is condemned as showing disrespect for the sacrifice of the honored noble soldiers. In modern-day America, the current global empire, gestural yet irrational slogans such as, "I am against the war but for the troops," are common, creating a kind of Orwellian doublethink that limits critical judgment. Likewise, a vast array of euphemistic language and rhetoric is common to war politics, specifically on the side of an aggressor nation. American journalist Walter Lippmann, famous for his concept of manufacturing of consent, a euphemism itself for how state power often uses propaganda and myth, rather than direct force as a means of social control, sarcastically stated, "We must remember that in time of war, what is said on the enemy's side of the front is always propaganda, and what is said on our side of the front is truth and righteousness, the cause of humanity, and a crusade for peace." As George Orwell wrote in his classic 1964 essay, Politics and the English Language, "In our time, political speech and writing are largely the defense of the indefensible." Things like the continuance of British rule in India, the Russian purges and deportations, the dropping of the atom bombs on Japan, can indeed be defended, but only by arguments which are too brutal for most people to face, and which do not square with the professed aims of political parties. Thus, political language has to consist largely of euphemism, question begging, and sheer cloudy vagueness. Social critic and comedian George Carlin satirized this phenomenon by coining the term humanitarian bombing. Since we effectively think in language, cultural associations made to specific terms outside of their clinical meaning can often bias one's reasoning in an irrational way. For example, stigmatizing labels can deter examination of issues simply by a kind of branding. Derisive use of the term communist in the early to mid-20th century is an example. This label was often imposed upon anyone with anti-capitalist sympathies, even when the accused might have had no other interest than to see a more egalitarian and equitable society. The term conspiracy theorist is another, more modern label, which serves to deter people from inquiring into any dishonest acts on the part of government or business. This term has become synonymous with irrational, used mockingly by politicians and the media. Likewise, the term terrorism has become the preferred politicized imperial symbol to incite fear and insecurity in a population. It can be viewed as a more modern version of the term communism in this sense. This insecurity helps open the door to various power abuses, as seen in the past with the spying and intimidation that occurred during McCarthyism in the 1950s. Today, the threat of terrorism is used similarly, justifying power abuses on the part of the government and allowing for acts of civil oppression and military aggression that otherwise would have no justification. As political theorist Carl Schmitt often argued, without a perceived enemy of a given society, something the majority feels threatened by in a unifying way, social cohesion and control may be jeopardized. Overall, political language by its very nature imposes an associative mental framework that, if reinforced properly, can narrow one's thoughts about social issues. Through this process, people lose focus on other possible factors or viewpoints. Political language also exploits our innate tendency to be superficial, short-sighted, and fragmented, as explored in Chapter 1. Language, therefore, beyond being our main tool to learn and communicate, can also function as a tool for social control by strategically imposing or restricting ideas, values, and biases through associative influence. Historically, the use or threat of violent force has been the general route to ensure public compliance by state power. We still see this extremism in societies such as Saudi Arabia's that engage in stoning, beheading, limb removal, crucifixion, and other barbaric practices for fairly modest crimes. Highly controlled state media, propagandized education, and concentrated political power have also contributed to ensuring social uniformity and compliance. However, the past half century has seen a rapid rise in demand for freedom and democracy. I place these terms in quotes, since how they are defined is highly subjective, as this text will explore in future chapters. Regardless, the Arab Spring event, triggered in 2010, is a modern example of this general growing global interest in moving away from overt dictatorship, monarchy, regimentation, and other echoes of older methods of state oppression and elitism. This long-term trend toward democracy, to whatever degree of definition or application, has challenged the nature of how national loyalty and status quo preservation is to be maintained. In other words, with populations becoming increasingly intolerant of overt oppression, other methods of social control by the establishment have been required, effectively cloaking the dominance effect. These newer techniques are perhaps best thought about as similar to those used in mass media persuasion or commercial advertising. It is increasingly about cultural manipulation rather than direct violent force. Interestingly, as shadowy as all this may seem, such control theory is far from obscure, despite the contradictory mythology assumed by most living in the self-proclaimed free societies of today. There has been consistent discourse among the intelligentsia that people simply need to be controlled. This has been viewed as a social imperative, not a nefarious act. One prestigious advocate of this view was Edward Bernays, who wrote a classic text appropriately called Propaganda in 1928. As will be addressed later in this book, Bernays' work also strongly shaped American advertising, helping to engineer a culture of material dissatisfaction to boost an economy driven by consumption. However, his ideas have also been applied to political persuasion. In fact, Nazi propagandist Joseph Goebbels is noted to have regarded Bernays' work quite highly in this context. Yet, Bernays was not malicious and simply saw this kind of need for social control as natural and necessary. He casually described the use of dishonesty and influence as though he was talking about an academic, anthropological reality. In Propaganda, Bernays writes, "The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. We are governed, our minds are molded, our tastes formed, our ideas suggested, largely by men we have never heard of. This is a logical result of the way in which our democratic society is organized. Vast numbers of human beings must cooperate in this manner if they are to live together as a smoothly functioning society." Within this context of propaganda, we find consistent mythological patterns that tend to exist in all nations. Revisionist history, or the sanitizing of a nation's past to control perception, is a classic example. Most nations tend to build great statues of their historical heroes, as though the actions taken by those people were with the intention of the current population's well-being. Like most Americans, I was taught that the great explorer Christopher Columbus discovered America, setting the stage for the creation of the land of the free and home of the brave. I was taught the settlers worked to civilize these stubborn Native American savages, bringing advanced knowledge and tools to help them evolve. I was also taught that the Founding Fathers preached how all men are created equal, and every American shall be granted the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Of course, none of those things are true. Millions were living in North America before Columbus's arrival. Settlers systematically closed in on the native cultures with genocidal techniques. The Founding Fathers omitted those of African descent from any form of equality to justify slavery. And the right to the pursuit of happiness could only have been directed toward the property-owning white male elite, who were the ones originally granted political privilege. At the time of the first major presidential election in 1789, only 6% of the population, white male property owners, was eligible to vote. From Genghis Khan to Napoleon to Alexander the Great to Francisco Pizarro Gonzalez, we see regional homage still given to these great conquerors today. The rhetoric is as though their actions were of a benevolent loyalty to their people. Of course, if the true acts of any of these figures were witnessed in the modern day, they would be seen as intolerant, xenophobic monsters. Modern variations on this theme range from the suggested worship of political leaders via noble portraits hanging in civic areas, as made famous by more totalitarian regimes, to the soft idolatry of naming libraries or airports after past U.S. presidents. These are echoes of a long tradition of power worship, harking back to such doctrines as the notorious Divine Right of Kings of 17th century Europe, which declared the monarch was subject to no earthly authority, deriving the right to rule and act directly from the will of God. This general pattern of codified or implied group superiority represents perhaps the most common and effective dominance myth in history. The view that one nation, religion, race, or whatever group is fundamentally superior to another has been at the root of vast historical injustices and atrocities. Of the numerous wars conducted over the past couple of centuries, very few have been publicly justified in terms of stealing something from another group of people or seeking strategic advantage over them, even though that has indisputably been the case overall. Arguably, all acts of war are foundationally acts of dominance, conquest, colonialism, or imperialism. Yet, this aggression is generally cloaked with the claim of defense or a humanitarian act of help. Today, this syndrome is best exemplified by the now cliched Western imperial ruse of seeking to spread freedom and democracy. Similar to the exploitated claim of fighting communism in the early 20th century, this paternalistic position suggests that the current political condition of a targeted nation is simply too corrupt or inhumane. Therefore, intervention to free its citizens or stop the spread of ill thought becomes a moral obligation of the invading power, as the rhetoric goes. This pattern of justification is also paralleled with the centuries of religious warfare and military evangelism common to the spread of Christianity, Islam, and other religions. The excuse to civilize a population with ostensibly more appropriate ethical or moral values has been common. From the Spanish conquistadors to the Crusades, to the persecution of Native Americans in the pre-United States, paternalistic excuses abound. For example, with respect to the latter, James Knowles, an early 19th century pastoral professor out of New England, famously argued that it was a religious mission to convert the Native Americans to Christianity. If they refused, it was morally acceptable to destroy them, as they were simply not respecting God's will. It is also worth noting that while many view the Crusades and other religious wars as purely ideological, evidence shows that material interests and trade expansion generally underscored these wars as well. Religion often serves to help galvanize and justify aggression or defense. This can be said about the modern Israeli-Palestinian conflict, too, where religious differences are really secondary to the dispute over land, security, and resources. This isn't to deny the existence of intolerant religious extremism. However, it will be found that regions with the most religious conflict or insurgent terrorism tend also to be regions with the greatest destabilization, insecurity, and history of foreign exploitation, scarcity, and deprivation. The process is systemic, with increased bigotry, racism, and xenophobia in themselves natural consequences of social and economic insecurity overall, even if disconnected in perception over time. As a final example of this cloaked ideological justification for war, the same rationale for eventually justifying the enslavement and inferiority of Africans in the early United States also led a pseudo-scientific charge to justify a colonial war to annex the Philippines at the turn of the 20th century. Fulfilling the emerging ideal of America's manifest destiny, this war was blatantly characterized in U.S. media as battling a primitive, backward people, even prompting the 1904 World's Fair to have on display imported villagers from the Philippines. Believe it or not, they were featured in the context of early man and stages of evolution. This display clearly reinforced the American public's sense of superiority and the illusion that the U.S. invasion was for the better in some paternalistic way. President Theodore Roosevelt did not mince words on the elitist view, stating in his 1902 Memorial Day address, Just at this moment, the Army of the United States is carrying to completion a war in which is involved not only the honor of the flag, but the triumph of civilization over forces which stand for the black chaos of savagery and barbarism. The warfare that has extended the boundaries of civilization at the expense of barbarism and savagery has been for centuries one of the most potent factors in the progress of humanity. This claim of cultural superiority also paves the way for other degrees of exceptionalism, invariably influencing the views of citizens, almost subconsciously, due to repeated media persuasion. Today, for instance, when Americans hear about U.S.-led international drone airstrikes that assassinate people deemed a threat to U.S. interests, there is great public outcry when apparent mistakes are made. For example, in Pakistan, U.S. drones have killed hundreds of innocent civilians in recent years. Yet little is said about why the U.S. is somehow exempt from international law and can send drones into almost any country, killing people with robots. That the U.S. has not been at war with Pakistan, and Pakistan certainly does not approve of the drones being sent into their region, makes it illegal. Yet the Western population has been so indoctrinated into this assumed exceptionalism, currently under the guise of anti-terrorism, that it barely raises an issue with the overt criminal behavior in and of itself, only questioning the apparent mistakes. Dominance theory. Building on the phenomenon of cultural exceptionalism, the study of social dominance has been a long-standing interest of sociologists. Whether we are dealing with international dominance between countries, or socioeconomic dominance between domestic classes, certain features and dynamics are consistent, leading to various theories attempting to explain why. One highly influential model is termed social dominance theory, SDT, established by psychologists Jim Sedanius and Felicia Prato. This theory attempts to explain the origin and consequences of social hierarchy and its related oppression. They state, "Prompted by the ubiquitous nature of group-based prejudice and oppression, we developed social dominance theory. The theory postulates that societies minimize group conflict by creating consensus on ideologies that promote the superiority of one group over others. Ideologies that promote or maintain group inequality are the tools that legitimize discrimination. The theory views all the familiar forms of group-based oppression, for example, group-based discrimination, racism, ethnocentrism, classism, sexism, etc., as special cases of a more general tendency for humans to form and maintain group-based hierarchy. In short, the theory claims humans are predisposed to group-based social hierarchies by nature. Strategic oppression through personal, social, and institutional means is hence deemed an immutable consequence of human nature. The theory also observes and catalogs various characteristics of social dominance hierarchies, notably hierarchy-enhancing and hierarchy-attenuating attributes. An example of a hierarchy-enhancing attribute is the police. They are designed, in part, to react against any insurrection that may arise from the lower-class have-nots against the upper-class haves. This is not an issue of conscious police bias per se. It is simply the structural reality of their position. On the other hand, civil rights movements are hierarchy attenuating, for they work against forces of disproportionate power and oppression. This theory also implies that without this structural oppression and elite preserving controls, society would be unstable. The authors state, "Social dominance theory, SDT, does echo elite theories stating that without a culturally normative and institutionalized control of power, social instability can devolve into extremely violent civil warfare. While proponents of SDT are quick to condemn any use of their theory as blanket political justification for social oppression, along with a rather vague denial of promoting any absolute biological determinism, the overall observations and hypotheses made undeniably gravitate toward those implications." Sedanius and Prato state, "Social dominance theory views group conflict as having less to do with structural features of the economy or culture than as being primarily driven by a ubiquitous human drive towards domination and group-based hierarchical social organization. The theory argues that a human predisposition termed social dominance orientation, SDO, drives this group-based hierarchy phenomenon. This is implied as an evolutionary trait in human psychology, generating a tendency toward favoring domination of others and other non-egalitarian interests. Surveys designed for this apparently measure the degree of SDO people have on a sliding scale, as utilized by SDT researchers. Social dominance theory goes on to distinguish three forms of dominance hierarchies. One relates to age hierarchy, such as children dominated by parents. Another relates to gender, observing the historical pattern of women dominated by men. And the final distinction is termed arbitrary set group hierarchies, which is basically all other types. While the first two distinctions are arguably worth debating, the arbitrary set hierarchies will be focused on here, as they are the most relevant to the discussion. The authors state, "The arbitrary set system is filled with socially constructed and highly salient groups based on characteristics such as clan, ethnicity, estate, nation, race, caste, social class, religious sect, regional grouping, or any other socially relevant group distinction that the human imagination is capable of constructing." Furthermore, while not directly stated in such terms by the researchers, there is effectively an environmental precondition that triggers the SDO personality trait, driving the creation of these group-based hierarchies. This has to do with the introduction of an economic surplus, according to the authors of the theory. When a society has sustained an economic surplus or excess of resources, people are theorized to have a predisposition to then create uneven distributions, manifesting social hierarchies. The authors write, "Even though there are temporal and inter-societal differences in the degree of group-based social hierarchy, the sad fact of the matter is that all known surplus-producing social systems are, in fact, organized as group-based social hierarchies. There are no known exceptions." Superficially, this idea of an existing economic surplus leading to the development of hierarchy is interesting, given how other social theories tend to link scarcity, not surplus, to hierarchy generating conflict overall. In much of the historical scholarship regarding factors that create and increase the propensity for most social conflict, resource scarcity, unequal wealth distribution, and deprivation are consistent preconditions. Naturally, many intersecting factors contribute to social destabilization and the push for increased hierarchical oppression. However, while a society's political system, religious values, and overall culture are important influences, the relevance of economic survival by way of needed resource access is no doubt the most critical. Any society, confronted with a severe survival risk, will likely become more divisive, aggressive, and competitive. The consistent emergence of property crime, inner-city gangs, sectarian violence, and even terrorism in areas plagued by insecurity and limited means shows how deprivation, along with the consequential feeling of injustice, sets the stage for not only appropriative competition, violence, and war, but also jingoism, racism, and bigotry. In fact, the effects of scarcity and related environmental conditions can be recognized both on a micro and macro scale, as well as short-term and long-term. Aside from the micro focus just mentioned, which can occur in a single generation, broad socio-environmental conditions experienced over long periods of time also appear to have powerful cultural effects. This field of study has been termed cultural anthropology and was notably made famous by Stanford anthropologist Robert Texter in his epic work, A Cross-Cultural Summary. It has been found that cultures spawned from resource-scarce desert regions are more prone to monotheism, conflict, stratification, male dominance, and female oppression, while cultures originating from lush, abundant forest regions tend to be more prone to polytheism, egalitarianism, fewer sexual taboos, improved women's rights, and less conflict. Naturally, these are broad, averaged, long-term observations with exceptions, but the consistency is nevertheless striking. Even non-human primates exhibit this broad geographical influence. Anthropologists have compared chimpanzees to bonobos, two species of apes that are the closest living genetic relatives to humans. Scientists found that due to their different environments, each ape culture has dramatically different social behaviors. Bonobo troops, living in lush, abundant rainforests, with females in the alpha roles, have very little conflict relative to chimpanzees. In contrast, chimpanzee troops living in raw, resource-scarce desert landscapes with males in the alpha roles have consistent conflict both in and out of the group. Yet, these two species are genetically almost identical. Of course, such primate analogs are never declaratory in and of themselves. Humans are simply not chimps or bonobos. Nevertheless, the correlations do have merit given our evolutionary relationship. Overall, the evidence shows that higher relative abundance, coupled with equitable distribution, correlates with a less stressful, more tolerant, and more peaceful society. Of course, this certainly doesn't mean a simple reduction of relative scarcity and inequality would immediately change culturally ingrained behaviors. Assuming a culture had already adapted to a life of scarcity and inequality, it would take adjustment away from the customs and values cultivated by that scarcity-based condition. Economist Herschel Grossman talked about the paradox of anticipated abundance, where groups who are expecting more resources will actually fortify protectionist activity and prepare for future conflict rather than simply ease such activity. In other words, economic surplus can create an immediate fear of future loss in this context, not a sense of ease. This makes sense given thousands of years of psychological, sociological, and structural patterns reinforcing the existence of conflict and dominance. In effect, we have generated a culture of conflict based on fear. This is not to deny evolutionary psychology as a factor, but to point out the extensive power that cultural tradition has over human behavior and social institutions. SDT omissions. While social dominance theory, SDT, offers insight into certain dynamics of how group-based human hierarchies interact, its view of causality is highly suspect. Social dominance orientation, SDO, the deterministic, ubiquitous drive that is said to lead to these hierarchies, generally omits the role culture plays in influencing behavior. Again, the basic logic is that once an economic surplus is introduced into a society, the SDO is triggered via people's evolutionary psychology, and groups then divide into hierarchies. As convenient as this theory is, and as empirical as the evidence may appear, environmental, social, and cultural factors are profoundly downplayed, as will be argued. The aforementioned statement, "The sad fact of the matter is that all known surplus-producing social systems are, in fact, organized as group-based social hierarchies, and there are no known exceptions," is interesting, because the distinction made is clearly in reference to hunter-gatherer societies, which, according to anthropologists, were generally without social hierarchy and did not have an economic surplus, according to the definition of SDT proponents. I submit that when we contrast the relatively egalitarian hunter-gatherer cultures with more recent hierarchical societies, the relevance of socio-environmental influence and culture becomes quite strong. In other words, there is more to it than simply the introduction of economic surplus. To explore this further, let's go back in time. Roughly 12,000 years ago, the human species transitioned from nomadic hunter-gatherer societies, tribes foraging and hunting with no agricultural skills, to farm-cultivating settled societies. This transition has been termed the Neolithic Revolution and set the stage for civilization as we know it today. This change marked a kind of technological shift. Like the advent of mechanization in the Industrial Revolution of the late 18th century, the discovery of agriculture was also the application of new economic technology. I point this out because it will be found that the most influential characteristic of a civilization is the kind of technological means it has and how it is applied. When very large changes in applied technology occur, human culture and behavior tend to change as well. It is interesting to think that for roughly 99% of our existence, Homo sapiens lived as hunter-gatherers, very few of which remain today. The different characteristics and social behavior between hunter-gatherer societies and modern settled societies are quite informative. Apart from being generally egalitarian with no real dominance hierarchy, it has been well argued by anthropologists that they also had much less violence and no large-scale organized warfare. They generally thrived in areas with a rich bounty of cereal grains and wild livestock. Their subsistence-level existence created a unique kind of minimalistic affluence, where scarcity was not an overarching sociological pressure. Such conclusions have been drawn partially from archaeological evidence from the pre-Neolithic period, but mostly from analysis of the few hunter-gatherer tribes that have existed in remote regions of the world over the past few centuries. Contrasting the hunter-gatherer society with modern society, anthropologist Marshall Salins states, "Hunter-gatherers consume less energy per capita per year than any other group of human beings, yet all the people's material wants are easily satisfied. To accept that hunter-gatherers are affluent is therefore to recognize that the present human condition of man slaving to bridge the gap between his unlimited wants and his insufficient means is a tragedy of modern times. Modern capitalist societies, however richly endowed, dedicate themselves to the proposition of scarcity. Inadequacy of economic means is the first principle of the world's wealthiest peoples. The market industrial system institutes scarcity in a manner completely without parallel, where production and distribution are arranged through the behavior of prices, and all livelihoods depend on getting and spending. Insufficiency of material means becomes the explicit, calculable starting point of all economic activity. In terms of sustainability, the economic simplicity of life made living beyond one's means virtually impossible. Unlike today, with the high technology to both create and destroy, there was a primitive natural balance with nature. At the same time, the inherent characteristics of nomadic life resulted in a very different sociology and culture from what we have today. For instance, since mobility was essential, hoarding property or basing identity on material possessions would have been impractical. The very idea of property rights, which underscores modern economics and in many ways our society itself, really didn't exist in hunter-gatherer culture. If we were to put these concepts in modern terms, hunter-gatherers had a gift economy in their communities, where they shared with no expectation of reciprocation. In fact, there are stories of outsiders being given handcrafts from existing tribes, only to feel the need to give something in return, as many in modern culture do. This reciprocal behavior was considered offensive by the tribe, as they felt the exchange was a refusal of friendship. British anthropologist Tim Ingold highlights the idea that the difference between giving and exchange has to do with social perception, based around autonomous companionship versus involuntary obligation. He states, "Clearly, both hunter-gatherers and agricultural cultivators depend on their environments. But whereas for cultivators, this dependency is framed within a structure of reciprocal obligation, for hunter-gatherers it rests on the recognition of personal autonomy. The contrast is between relationships based on trust and those based on domination." The Neolithic Revolution set in motion a chain reaction, moving society toward very different social structures and values. The central mechanism of this change was the increased dependence on those geographical features required for economic success in the new paradigm of agriculture and settlement. In what has been called geographical determinism, it has been established that certain societal characteristics of a particular culture are historically shaped by geographic conditions. Similar to the aforementioned work in cultural anthropology, with unique differences developing between desert and forest societies over long periods of time, these ancient environmental preconditions set in motion trajectories for development that tend to become separated from their origins. In other words, over generations, people lose touch with why their traditions and practices exist, perpetuating them regardless. As extensively argued by researcher Jared Diamond, the developmental path of human society, specifically the modern reality of socioeconomic and national inequalities, has been linked to different geographic exposures since the Neolithic Revolution. From the standpoint of farming, animal domestication, resource extraction, and other practices common to the new post-Neolithic era, the surface of the earth was certainly not uniform in capacity. Some regions were more favorable than others, with more ideal climates, terrains, conditions, and resources. Keep in mind, thousands of years ago, our ancestors lacked advanced technologies such as trains, synthetic fertilizers, and other modern realities that help level the economic playing field. There was no chance of farming arid zones or building cities in the desert, as we now have in places like Las Vegas. These early differences have had a dramatic effect on the evolution of human civilization, since the geographical advantages and disadvantages inherent resulted in some regions developing technology and improved means faster than others. This unequal development set the stage for material inequality and disproportionate power in terms of a region's capacity for conflict and war. For example, if one regional group discovered how to make guns while another regional group was still using only swords, the latter region would clearly be at a disadvantage in times of war. This unequal regional advancement in technology throughout history has strongly affected the state of the modern world. At the same time, these new environmental pressures and dynamics of the agricultural mode of production became the framework for a new culture. A natural logic based on the emerging requirements of survival guided development into predictable patterns of psychological and sociological thought, molding institutional practices. Expanding vocations and specialization is one such pattern, since division of labor generally improves overall productive efficiency. A specific person in a community is tasked to create a tool the community can use, developing a disproportional skill over time. Suddenly, that skilled person has a differential value compared to those who lack that specific skill, but maintain other skills that may also be helpful. This then logically leads to barter, credit systems, and other means of trade, slowly evolving economic exchange networks between and within communities. Furthermore, the practice of expanding trade naturally stimulates the formal institution of property and the need for rights and protection to help ensure some security and fairness. After all, creating a basic tool in early history could be very time-consuming and resource-intensive. Growing a field of corn only to have it rot or be stolen was certainly something to protect against. From this emergence of property, we get the root foundation of state regulation and institutional force. We also get the formation of a culture whose people begin to perceive life through a kind of scarcity and protectionist worldview. Again, this is something that really didn't exist in prior hunter-gatherer reality. Given disproportionate production skills and the unequal benefits